I know there's a bunch of musicians that at some point started an email list and they're like, oh, I haven't emailed them in 2 years. I can't email them now. And what I would say to that is like, you absolutely can. You just get real with them. Be like, I know you've been on this list because you saw me at X shows. You acknowledge how they got there. And you're like, my bad. Boo on me. So sorry about like ghosting you, but I'm back. And I'm really excited to hear what's been going on with you. You can acknowledge and get back in once your system is back set up. So that's something I hear a lot is like, I had a list, I haven't touched it, so I guess it's moot.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music production, and the music business. My guest today is Grammy-nominated singer, composer, speaker, and career coach, Cheryl Engelhart. Cheryl began her career as an advertising and film composer in New York City, creating jingles for national ad campaigns. She then pursued a career as a pop rock singer-songwriter and had songs placed in television and film, as well as touring internationally with her backing band. Cheryl gradually transitioned into New Age music and was nominated for a Grammy Award for Best New Age, Ambient, or Chant Album in 2022. She's also a certified trauma-informed master coach, and her In the Key of Success coaching program provides career coaching, helping musicians attain their goals. During the interview, we talked about how Cheryl got into jingle writing, being a left-handed piano player, creating her making of videos, tips for creating emails, her first job as a scuba diver, and much more. I spoke with Cheryl via Zoom from a home in New York. So, again, thank you for taking the time. I looked at a lot of the material that you have online, and I must say I'm really impressed by a lot of things. But what I want to talk to you most about is your jingle writing.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Tell me about your jingle writing career.
My jingle writing career. It's a really funny start. My sister's best friend from college's dad owned an editing house in New York City where they edited commercials. And I was kind of realizing that I wanted to do music and I was playing in some bands. So I was like, you know what? Let me take her up on meeting him. And I met the head of this company and he was like, we've got two positions. We usually have we start people out either in the front desk answering phones or in the mailroom. And he's like, honestly, usually the girls go to the front desk and the guys go to the mailroom. I was like, okay, but where do you get to like learn from the editors and like sort of tag along? He's like, oh, the mailroom people, when they're not delivering, they can like go. And I'm like, put me in the mailroom. And he was like, okay. And I was the first girl in the mailroom. And I basically was a messenger in Manhattan for 9 months. And I skipped everyone that was in line to become an assistant editor at this commercial editing house because anytime I wasn't running around with a DigiBeta or, I'm dating myself with the tapes, delivering them to the ad agencies or even the music houses, I would be learning all the editing and like being in the rooms, trying to like really be helpful. In my deliveries, I would deliver the cuts, the edits to some of these music houses, jingle houses. And I would go into these gorgeous studios that were just working on jingles and commercial music. And I was like, oh, I want to go here. So there's one that was the top of floor, beautiful views of Union Square. And I basically like came in and I met the bot. I delivered it. And I was like, hi, I work at this company, Crew Cuts, right now, but I am really a musician and would love to work here. Do you have any openings? And they were like, no, but you can call and follow up in a month or so. So I did for 11 months. I called the owner of this company and the 11th time, and he kept saying, call next month. Like I got permission to. And the 11th time, he's like, actually, our assistant tech just left. We need an assistant tech. And I had a background in working in recording studios. So I got my first job at the Jingle House as an assistant tech. And I would stay late after the composers left and try to write on what they were working on during the day and then pitch what I did the next day. And I started winning and I started getting my stuff placed on air. So then I became a composer at this Jingle House until I ended up leaving 3 years later to go tour and do my own thing. So that's kind of the story. And now I do freelance. I still work. I have a lot of connections and with a lot of different Jingle Houses, and I'll still get called every once in a while to do different kinds of things. But yeah, that's that story.
That's fascinating. But okay, you just opened something else up. So you have a background in a recording studio as well.
Yeah, I was an intern at a hip hop recording studio. It was something I did during college, one of my summers, to sort of see. I thought maybe I wanted to get into engineering, and I was in the music tech department in college. And I thought that was a route I wanted to go until I spent a couple summers there and realized that I like Windows and I do not like the smell of pot. and I mean, I know that there's different vibes for different studios. And the one that I was in was like, you know, it was super cool. But the engineers that were working there were really great. And I wasn't just cleaning the toilets, although I did. They really taught me patch bays and cutting and Pro Tools and like all of the things. And I really got to cut my teeth on some of the world of tech, which I think has really served me in producing my own stuff and being able to get around a live show, a mixing board, like anywhere I've gone in the industry moving forward as an indie musician. I've been able to speak pretty much any language and been able to communicate with engineers, sound people, you know, lighting, everything. So I'm very grateful for that time, but it was also a little bit of a process of elimination to figure out what I did not want to be doing in the vast industry of music.
Yeah, that's kind of the way that works though when you first start.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't hate trial and error to a degree. You know, throwing spaghetti against the wall and seeing what sticks is fine, but especially if it's gluten-free spaghetti, that's expensive. You don't want to do that too often. Yeah.
Your material is very dense orchestrally. And I'm saying this in a way that I kind of respect, because what it is, there's a lot of things that I couldn't do. You know, I look at it and I go, wow, where did you come up with that? How did you learn orchestration like that?
I mean, I play the piano. So I was a piano player from the age 2, 3 early on and loved to experiment. And I did a lot of vocal stuff. And I realized that the way I write vocals was how I would also pretty much write for a string quartet. And when I learned that the crossover there as a composer was not as big of a gap as I thought it was, I ended up applying to do some postgraduate work studying orchestration specifically at Juilliard. And so I took some courses there, so got some formal training, just felt like that was a hole in my college education and growing up with piano and vocal stuff. So piano is funny. As soon as I enrolled for some of these programs, I ended up getting called to do a couple orchestral type of gigs. I was doing a lot of scoring projects for College Humor at the time. They're, you know, funny content stuff, but we did like a Minute Maid musical that was like sponsored by Minute Maid. And it was like sort of like a ripoff of the beginning of Beauty and the Beast going through town in the morning, you know, and I started to see the need for this skill, even if it wasn't like a formal classical symphonic commission or anything. So it was kind of fun to be able to bring that in, orchestral pieces and some of the rules of orchestra writing into the commercial writing and even into my own songwriting. I do a lot of the string arrangements and stuff that when I was doing some pop, I have 4 sort of piano pop records out before I started doing new age records, which is now kind of where I live, and a little bit of the classical crossover stuff. So it kind of just expanded my tool belt.
Okay, going back a little further. So you studied classical piano, but you're left-handed.
Ah, I know, the poor bass players that play with me in bands. I constantly have to remind myself to give them a little bit of room, just a little bit.
But that being said, was that an impediment to you? Since the piano is so right-handed.
I don't think so. It never occurred. I mean, I'm one of those left-handed people that like I throw right-handed, like I'm not complete. And maybe that's because of playing the piano and having the, you know, melodic stuff in the right hand. But because I learned so early, I learned how to play the piano well before I learned how to write. So I don't even think it was known back then that I was left-handed. And I was just doing all the scales, both hands, you know, like Cheryl likes ice cream. Cheryl likes ice cream. It's no wonder I have a sweet tooth, by the way, but whatever. I never thought of it that way, other than I know my left hand really wants to be active and loud. And I've always had to work on the balancing of it, not because my right hand was incompetent, but more because my left hand was like overly, you know, excited. I also like the big, deep, dark kind of big chords. So it might just be a compositional sort of preference as well that I kind of can dig in there and have to monitor that, or at least I used to.
Okay, so you're working at the agency, and then you decided to become an artist. So what brought that on?
Well, I had kind of been playing around with my own. I had already had an album out that was, my first album is like, what genre do you think you are? I was kind of trying to figure it out and just play with people that I really enjoyed being around and, you know, people that are still my friends. I'm actually, the drummer that I worked with was a brother of a friend that I went to college with, and he's now the drummer for Lake Street Dive. I'm literally seeing them tomorrow at Madison Square Garden, which I'm so excited, so proud of them. But just to be able to be around really cool people and collaborate was what that first album was all about. And then I realized, okay, I want to do this better. And so when I had gotten the job at the Jingle House, there are these beautiful studios, four or five different studios. So I recorded a couple albums there after hours, and I got, you know, got permission because like what else was going to be used and how else were the, you know, the people, everyone, the composers, older composers all went home at five. And, you know, so I was like, can I use these studios? So it was a really great time for me to be able to expand and have some time to dig into my own artistry. So they kind of went hand in hand. Like I had access to this space and I was able to engineer my own stuff. And then I started touring on the weekends or leaving early Fridays, coming back Monday mornings, like getting out as far as I could from New York City, like Portland and Philly and Boston, and anytime I could get away and do some sort of performance to support the whatever I had just released. It's kind of, they kind of went hand in hand. It wasn't like, oh, I'm at a commercial house. Now I would like to do my own stuff. It kind of already was going in that direction by the time I got there.
How about when you made the shift to New Agey?
I had applied to a bunch of different sort of composer residencies just to kind of get out of my own way. This is now years after leaving the Jingle House and have been doing freelance. And so I got accepted to this writing. It was an artist's retreat in Greece on a tiny mountain town, like half abandoned mountain town. And I was the composer. There were painters, sculptors. It was all sorts of artists. And I had 2 weeks and I thought I was going to write text. I didn't even know there were musical instruments or anything there. I thought I was going to write text for a potential choral album because I had been doing some choral work. And I got there and they walked me into this like stone cave that opened up into this gorgeous stone room with a grand piano in it. And they're like, this is your room. And I was like, game on. I have 2 weeks to create like the reverb in that room. Like it was incredible. And I knew whatever I started there, I had to finish because there was no way to recreate in the studio that sound. And it was really cool. I brought a bell. I did some vocal weird. There are no lyrics on this. And I had to record it late at night when the cicadas were not screaming their heads off in the day. My microphone literally was picking up cicadas. And then at night when I would do these like, ooh, like vocal things, the dogs would start howling. So I would have to wait. Record. And so I would spend the day editing whatever I could lay down the night before. And I just kind of did this experimental go with the flow, very unlike my pop music process. And I did these 10 6-minute pieces and I kind of wanted to do something that could, I was struggling with anxiety and I was listening to music and meditations, but everything either like put me to sleep or it was like so melodic, like classical music that my ear would just go, I wasn't processing anything. And I was like, what if I created pieces that started a little tension filled or fast or like met me at my where I was. And then over the 6 minutes sort of brought me out of it. And I was like, I wonder if that's a thing that could work. And I did it and I released it as an album and immediately number one on iTunes, Amazon, Bandcamp, like all these places. And I was like, that's never happened with my pop records, like ever. And I was like, whoa, and got placed on Spotify playlists. And like suddenly I never had touched streaming before, never cared about my Spotify. Like, I was like, why would I bother with that? It's like, I'm asking my fans to buy and come to shows and like do all this stuff. I'm not going to bother with like a 0.003 cent. Like that just didn't seem like a good business plan. But suddenly I've got, you know, a Spotify following and like, I was like, am I a New Age artist? And then the pandemic hit and I was like, all right, let's do another one. Like I produced that all myself. I mixed it and I was like, all right, I think I did another one. Same thing, did really well. Third one I did after a friend passed away. It was just sort of the tail end of COVID. And I got on a cross country train just to kind of get away. And I love trains. And I brought my little teeny keyboard and I was like, let's just do something in the box, meaning just no recording because I was so noisy. And I came up with these pieces that were just really my real ambient work. Like there's a lot of space, like really different from, you can hear me talk and get excited and passionate. There's a lot of words. There's a lot. This was the opposite of that. And that is called The Passenger. And that New Age album got nominated for a Grammy. And so I kind of was like, all right, I guess I am here to stay. And I really love the genre. I love what it's doing for mental health. I love what it allows people to process, whether or not it's the same. I'm not dictating what I want people to process, like a, you know, a pop song it's about a breakup. Like, we're all now sharing in the sadness of the breakup. Like, pop songs, country songs, they sort of dictate the emotion, which is kind of fun when you're like, I want to feel something. I need a good cry. You can go to your songs. You can go to the Sarah McLachlan Arms of an Angel, and you know what you're going to get. But I think with New Age, it's kind of like, here's a platform for you to process whatever you need to at the moment. And it may not be what I needed to when I created this, but here's this tool. So I really loved hanging out in this genre.
I had a similar experience in that I was trying to meditate, and the music, again, would either put me to sleep or I'd focus on it so much that I couldn't meditate.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what it's like, you get so analytical about things sometimes.
Yep.
So I composed my own pieces.
There you go.
And that helped a lot in that they come from you. So, you know, they're purposely built, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It helped a lot, I have to say.
Hmm.
I should really go back and try to do that again now that I think about it. You inspired me.
Yeah, cool.
Okay, so another thing I noticed that was very cool that I don't see from other artists is you do a lot of making of videos that will pull you right in to the whole thing. It pulls you into the process, but it pulls you into the material as well. So how do you come up with that?
I've always, like, I'm coming into like almost 20 years of having an email list for my fans and collecting emails. And the majority of the people on that list were from live shows. Like, I always made it a game that 50% of the people in any room would sign up, and like was really clear about it, made it really easy for them. And I always was aware of like, I have this group of people that I'm so grateful for, because I do know all the statistics about email marketing. They're more likely, 9 times more likely to purchase something via an email versus social media, all this stuff. So I really value that they're there. And even as I pivoted from pop to New Age, I was like, oh, I'm going to lose on my list. Everyone's like, cool, game on. Where do we need to buy this? Like, they're ready to go. Like, it's almost like I've not trained them, but like, they know what the relationship is and the partnership, and they know what I'm up to. And they're sort of, I think everyone's just got their popcorn out and they're like, how is this going to go? Does this girl have a Grammy yet? Like, what's happening? And so I value that. And when I'm creating, I never know if something's going to be great. Like, when I went to Greece, I was like, this is just a little composer 2 week little retreat for me to like get into my muse and whatever. Didn't know if I was going to release it. Same thing with getting on the train. I was like, maybe I can do an album in 5 days across on a train. Like, I don't know. Let's see. But I always have put my ego aside and that fear of like, if I say this, that I might do this thing out loud and I don't do it, am I going to feel stupid? Am I going to feel like a loser? Am I going to be disappointed in myself? Am I going to feel shame? And so often I see musicians, especially musicians I coach, not taking action because they're afraid of their own potential emotions. And so I remember making a decision being like, I'm going to be able to handle whatever emotions that come up. And I'm just going to say this and share with people and make videos and make sure that I record enough stuff while I'm here so that I can make something later if I need it. And I did that with the train trip. I did that with the second album, The Seeker Slumber. My back was out and I like did a lot of it from bed. I got, you know, in a sweatshirt. So like none of it's glamorous. It's very like just me and my phone. But I try to capture moments that are interesting. And I never am editing like on the spot. Like I let myself be in the process and I just like turn my phone on when I can remember it and like set it up in right ways and just edit it later. And so that's what's come of these videos that I've, the making of videos that are on my homepage, and sort of bring people into the process enough that they feel like they want to purchase the whole album, that they want to support it. So yeah, very sort of guerrilla marketing kind of stuff. But
yeah, but that being said, there's a purpose behind them, but it's not so slick that it feels pretentious. And yeah, that's what I find with a lot of making of videos. And that's not with yours at all.
I think it's because when I'm making it, I do see a lot of making of videos, and they make it after they get the slick cameras and the da da da. And they're not like they're now in a different phase of the process, which is great. They're in the promotion phase. So it feels like they're promotion. When I'm recording the videos, I'm in the process. So I think that might be a very subtle energy difference, is that when I'm editing it, I'm in promotional mode and I'm editing, but like the actual, what was captured was me in the emotion of it, in the rawness, in the like, I don't know how this is going to go. Let's go. Like, and I think that energy, I don't know, I'm just sort of, I haven't thought about this, this is an interesting point, but I think because I'm not actually in promotion mode, I'm in creation mode. And I also don't know what's going to come out, that I can bring people in from that angle versus the, hey, I have this thing that you need to know about. Let me tell you all the stories and who's involved and give you, like, which is fine, especially for your Uber fans. But for people that are just getting to know you, I think it's a little more raw. It's a little more vulnerable. It's a little more like, we don't know how this is going to go. But I think that brings in some curiosity and fun, and it kind of makes people feel like they were there at the start.
Oh yeah, definitely does. It makes it enjoyable. And again, it doesn't feel like a sales video at all. None of them that I watched anyway felt like.
Yeah, no, they're not sales videos. I mean, they're really connection videos, and they're kind of just like, hey, I did this thing. If you're interested in it, you can watch. I made these videos to share with you if you're interested. And that's really like, there's usually not a call to action. Some of them are for your consideration for Recording Academy members if I submitted it to the Grammys. But like, other than that, there's usually, and that's not even a call to action. It's literally like you can't even say, please vote, or you can't even say, please consider. It's just for your consideration, right? There's all these rules. So there's really never a call to action in them. Sometimes there's like, you can go listen on my website, but that's it.
There are 15 simple mix fixes that can instantly take your mixes from amateur to pro level. These are the secrets that the top engineers know that most musicians don't. That's what you'll find in my Mix Fix playbook. Head to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. It seems to me, though, that approach is something that you use in your emails as well, because it feels so personal. And even though you may be getting to a point with the call to action, it never feels, again, salesy or anything from what I've seen.
Thank you. I think that I've tried hard to make sure that I don't think I've tried hard. I'm talking comes naturally. And so, you know, people ask, like, what's your strategy around getting number one on iTunes or getting a Grammy nomination? And I'm like, make a thing and then talk about the thing, like, with the passion from which you made it. Right? Like, connecting that, not just, you know, so for me, like I said, I started my email list like a million years ago. And I was inspired by Sarah Bareilles, who, before she got big, she was really funny on her email list. And then she moved over to the record label, and then the label would send out their like official form, like newsletters. And I was like, really missed that connection. And I swore to myself that I would always keep my email list going. And I mean, there have been times when like nothing's happened for 6 months and I didn't have a series, like an automated series going with like back end stories, which I do now. So like, if I get kidnapped by aliens for half a year, like my people are still getting some communications from me. But I do think it's important to just not always be selling and to be connecting. And every once in a while, run a poll. I always share. I do a lot of my own album cover designs, and I will come up with three or four and I'll run a poll with my fans. Private link, like which one, and I'll vote and I'll use the one that they vote on. Like I bring them in. Even my the top I wore as a Grammy nominee was, it looked like all these little like white flowers, but real with like black in the middle. But what it was I said, hey, if you want to come on the red carpet with me, give me like, write your name in handwritten and send it to me. And I got them all screen printed. So I had about 100 signatures, my family, friends, even my dad who passed away. I had a note from him with his, you know, dad. And so there are all these little flowers that were screen printed. And then the seamstress made them into little like florets with my fans' names on them all over the shirt. So it's a lonely business, but we're doing it for people. So it is a people business. So how can I bring them in? And email has been the easiest way to do that for me. Honestly, I don't need to depend on an algorithm's timing and what they're favoring and the right hashtag. Like, I can just send an email and I know that they'll open it if my subject line is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Tell me about your transition into coaching. How do you decide to do that?
Early on, like when I was just after I left the Jingle House and I started touring, I had some licensing successes, like a couple good placements on some commercials and TV shows. And I sort of had I played some festivals. I had a bunch of like nice indie little wins. And I started getting asked to speak at music conferences, smaller music conferences. And I remember Lou Playa, who's the CEO of Reverb Nation, came up to me afterwards. He's like, you need to write a book. And I was like, no, I do not want to write a book. But it planted a seed in like, and I started really listening to the questions that people would ask afterwards in the Q&As. And I realized that a lot of musicians had a lot of the same question buried in different circumstances, different genres. And at the time, I was doing this leadership program just for my own personal development. And I really enjoyed kind of stepping in front of a room and speaking. And I also wanted to get better at answering people's questions and not just do what I see a lot of people do now, which is like, here's what I did. So here, which is just advice, right? And I didn't want to just give advice. I wanted to actually break through. Okay, why is this like everyone's question? Why is everyone like self-sabotaging? They want to be seen on stage, but they have something that's stopping them from being seen, the number one thing that they want. And I slowly started to just do more and more training. And I got certified as a trauma-informed coach. And at the same time, I'm doing my work for myself as well, like we're getting over my stuff and working on my anxiety. And just one thing led to another. So I started coaching probably 15 years ago and created a couple programs, started to figure out that my shtick, I really loved communication, like pitching was really powerful. I did a couple experiments with my own pitching tours to figure out like a perfect pitch. And that was the first like official course I created. And then I really dug into email and like I got certified as a digital marketing expert. Like I dorked out on email marketing because I saw how effective it was already with me for 8 years with my fans. And I was like, okay, there's something here. But like, again, I don't want to just say, here's what I did because I have a weird story and like no one else is going to have the same story as me. So I wanted to be able to go broader so I could go deeper in specific, which is a weird way to phrase that. So I created the Rock Your Email List, my email course that is like the start to finish, build the email, get rid of the tech blocks because tech can be such a block for people. And like, what do I send and how often do I send it and how do I get people to open it and what do I put in the subject line? Just laid it all out. And yeah, that kind of really opened up a larger audience. And I realized people wanted more support. So I created Amplify 9 years ago, which is a monthly mastermind. And I have a retreat. And I just really love interacting with musicians who have kind of been around the block. They've created something and they get stuck. They're like, now what? I've done all the things I know to do. Now what? Like, that's my happy place when I get to sort of work with them and answer that question and figure out, okay, what's actually stopping you from moving forward? Because you know what to do. Most musicians know what to do, but they've assumed they've done it already. And they probably have, but with this block in place. So my job is to come and like chisel some of this stuff out.
You know what it's like. Musicians would rather create. I mean, that's the number one thing. I'd just rather create, do my own thing, and not sell and not worry about the business part. But it is the music business, so you have to worry about it. And it's good when people finally come around that realization where it's like, okay, if I want to be successful, I really have to embrace that somehow.
Yeah, I like to integrate it. And so it's not like I have to do this and then I have to do this. It's like, I mean, which is true. There is a process. But I mean, the way I was talking about recording during my process, I have my fans front and center. The second I hit record on my phone, like I'm connected to them, right? And I'm thinking about them. And if I have a decision to make where I'm not sure what creative choice to make, I think of what would my fans like. You know, I make decisions for myself, but I always think that branding, like I think of two circles that overlap a little bit. Branding and fan connection and selling is like where your values and what you like overlaps with their values. You don't have to be on top of the identical, but if there's a little bit of overlap and you know that and you can be mindful while you're creating, then it doesn't feel like, oh, now I have to go sell. It's just part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me, what exactly is a trauma-informed coach?
It just means that I am trained to deal with and look at things that have happened in the past that are dictating or influencing actions that someone may or may not be taking in the present and in the future. So that could be trauma. You know, people think of most often when you hear that word, you think of capital T trauma, like a divorce, a car accident, an attack, something like that. But most people have experienced some level of what we call lowercase T trauma, which is more chronic. Like if there's chaos in the house or an unpredictable parent or neglect or something, then we have like a trauma response. A really common one I see with a lot of artists is they want to be seen. They want to have a million followers and get on stage for tens of thousands of people, but they are actually terrified because something happened probably when they were little where they were seen and it didn't go well. Like that could be someone who was attacked to all the way to just someone making fun of your clothes when you're in second grade, right? And just being laughed at or something. And so there's this little kid in the body, stuck in the body energetically, that's like self-sabotaging the current you. And that's why you can't get on bigger stages. That's the block. So if you go back and heal and figure out what did that little kid need and give it to them, now that opens up some space energetically and even just actionably to say, okay, I feel safe to now go onto the stage. I'm not going to sabotage it, because the body is like, hey, that happened before and it did not go well. So I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to get a cold so we can't go on the big stage, or I'm going to like, you know, get into a big fight with someone and then I'm going to get fired. And like, we think that it's like stuff happening to us, but we have so much more power than we realize. So being able to bring that into someone's career conversation is, and it's not always necessary, but it's a really, really big tool on the tool belt. Once I got that certification and was able to really see, oof, we can go back deeper and heal stuff. So now people are like, you know, yes, we're doing way better and doubling income and getting all our millions of Spotify. But like, people that I coach with now are like meeting the person they're going to marry. They're like losing their 15 pounds that they couldn't lose. Like, there's other stuff happening because this is getting, I'm like, oh, that's very cool. Let's keep doing that.
Yeah, right. No, that is. You talked about email before, and I agree with you. I think that's probably the most powerful tool that we have. What are a couple of things that people don't either realize about their email list or don't utilize enough?
A couple of things immediately come to mind. I know there's a bunch of musicians that at some point started an email list and they're like, oh, I haven't emailed them in 2 years. I can't email them now. And what I would say to that is like, you absolutely can. You just get real with them. Be like, I know you've been on this list because you saw me at X shows, or what, you acknowledge how they got there. And you're like, my bad, boo on me. So sorry about like ghosting you, but I'm back and I'm really excited to hear what's been going on with you. Also 2020 to 2024 doesn't really count anyway, right? Like, isn't that kind of, like you can acknowledge and get back in once your system is back set up. So that's something I hear a lot is like, I had a list, I haven't touched it, so I guess it's moot. That's the first thing. It's not moot. It doesn't matter how long it's been. You can wake up a sleepy list, no problem. The second thing that I see musicians that do have a list, and I'll talk to the people that haven't even set one up because they're like, I just want to be famous on TikTok, and I'll address that. The second big thing that I see is I see a lot of people summarize the newsletter, email, whatever they're sending out in their subject line, which gives the reader zero reason to open the email because they just got the synopsis in the subject line. And they're not going to be able to. So if you're like, live show Friday, new single out, blah, 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 like, they're not going to get to read your emails. And in your text, in your copy, is where your personality lives. It's where the relationship lives. So you want the email, the subject line to be, you don't want to mislead them, but you want it to be just enough FOMO, just enough like a question mark of what's happening here that they want to open and read what you've got. So that's a big thing that I see a lot is the summarization of the email and the subject line. Because why would I open it? I thank you for the summary. Now I don't need to read this email.
I'm guilty of that myself, I think. Now that you mentioned it, I'm rethinking. I have an email campaign about to start next week, and I'm thinking to myself, what did I do in my subject lines? I better go back and check.
Yeah. There's a lot of do's and don'ts with subject line. I love the subject line conversation. For people that are like, oh, I'm on social, and that's where I'm putting all my focus, which is great. And I know a lot of musicians that hate social media. I have a thing called the content drop, which is like the short cut. Like, here's a couple trending audios. Just do this month. You don't need to make a million things. But there are some musicians that are like, I'm going hardcore on TikTok right now. I'm going hardcore on Instagram. I don't need an email list. And I would say good for you for going hardcore and like being motivated and creating great content. And even if you go viral on TikTok, you will have 15 minutes of fame and you will never see those people again. I want you to capture those people. So every couple posts, you should have a link in your bio, link somewhere in the stories, whatever, that says, hey, I've got some exclusive cool stuff for you only on email. Make sure you're in my email world. I never say email list and I never say newsletter. We are not in a newsletter culture anymore. We are in a one topic per email, one, you know, when we're scrolling, it's one image per caption, you know. So just say my email world, my email realm, like go plop your email, tell me where to send and have some sort of free curated bundle. If you have a bunch of albums out, I like picking one song, like your favorite song from each album and letting them know and giving that away. Something really easily consumable. You can just, you know, send them a Google Drive zip file link, something that's easy to deliver and get those people. Social media is a great way to grow an email list, especially if you have a good engaged following on social. Test it out. But you can't just post once. It's got to be a regular thing. And I think it's a great way to get engagement over an email And what I do is I always, always favor my email list. If I have some news or a new release, even if it's just a half an hour earlier, my email list gets the news first. And then I'll go post on social. So just that little bit of like, they saw it there first on email will say, okay, I'm being valued here. My email is valuable to this person, to this musician. So I make sure to, that's another thing, is to always just send anything you've got. If you can delay whatever news you've got by a day, great. Send it to the email list first and then post on social later.
That's fantastic. That's great. Great advice. I love it.
I'm telling you, it works.
There's one last thing I want to talk to you about. And I guess I must have read it in your website, but it was something about your first job being a scuba diver for the USGS.
My first official, like, out of college paid job. I mean, I had so many odd jobs before then, but like the first 9 to 5 was, I was a double major at college. I was a music major in the music tech department, and I was a biology major. And I thought I was going to go into marine biology or maritime law or something water related. And I got recruited because I was working for the ecology department at Cornell while I was there. And they got me certified in scuba diving. And so I got recruited for this research team, and we were doing water quality research on the Delaware River because the water quality was going down. But what we were looking for, and why I was scuba diving, because first of all, the river is really fast. So it was not about the depth. It was more that when you're in scuba gear, you have control over your weight and your position in the water. We were looking for mussels because single mussel will filter 100,000 gallons of water a day, I think is the stat. That was a very long time ago. So we were looking at the populations of 9 different mussels, and I think 2 of them were endangered species. So we would just, you know, there were 8 or 9 of us that would like go spread out across the river, and we'd spend a whole day, and we'd go every like 100 feet. We'd have this like, it's called a quadrat survey basically, and put our little thing down, and we'd take notes of like what plants were there, how many of what species of mussels were there. So I'd like, you know, memorize and identify, be able to identify mussels. And I did that for like 6 months until the river was like freezing or something. So we had a little time off. And in that time off, a friend of my mom's chiropractor or something knew that I also wrote music and was like, hey, will you come to Rome, Italy with me for a month to write music for this website I'm developing? They had all these little videos that needed some music. And I also went and did some videography. So I went and did that. And I was like, this is way cooler than neoprene and being underwater. And that's when I was like, I'm going to New York City. I'm going to do music. So yeah, I did that job for like about 6 months, and it was great. It was super fun. And, but it got old.
Yeah, you're like light years away from that now. Jeez.
I am light years away from that. Although I do regularly go kayaking. I'm looking out of the Hudson River right now. I like have a stand-up paddleboard that I'm looking at down there, and I swim, and I was, you know, on the crew team in college. Like I'm still like a water baby, yeah. Through and through.
Yeah, me too. If I had my brother, I'd be at the beach right now. But
yeah.
Last question, Cheryl. Yes. And thanks. This has been great. I really enjoyed getting to know you better.
Thank you. This has been fun.
What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way, or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Don't do it alone. Get someone one step ahead of you. Get a coach, get a mentor. Like the figuring it out on your own is like mildly heroic, but it's mostly for your ego. So toughing it out, like for a long time, will feel like you're just a badass. But like actually getting results is like way more badass. And you're more likely to get those results, I think, if you are working with someone, if you're investing in yourself, if you're surrounded by people going to conference, like just don't do the lone wolf thing. It like literally doesn't serve anybody.
That's I love it. That. That's great. That's a story of my life, by the way. So
yeah, so you're
point that out.
Okay, cool. Yeah, every time I start working with someone, like stuff shows up and I'm like, that can't be a coincidence. Like it just can't. Yeah.
No, I understand completely. And really, it's only been later in my life that I learned that it's okay to go get some help, and it's probably going to be better for you in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree with you. Thanks so much for your time. This has been great. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.